Okay, this is talking with Sandy Weinreb at ERSI meeting in Helsinki on 31st July 1978. And as I said before, we're just going to cover the first part of your career. But can you tell me what was your educational background and how you first came in contact with radio astronomy?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was an undergraduate at MIT and had been always interested in receivers. That is, my boyhood ambition sort of was to build the very best communication receiver. And I had worked a lot on that. I guess the summer of my junior year, I started in 54, so this must have been around summer of 57. I decided to spend the spring vacation going through the yellow pages of the Boston phone book, and I just called up everybody under electronics and under physicist, and I got about 10 interviews, and one of them was with Ewan Knight Corporation, in Needham, and I interviewed with Pete Strum, who was sort of the chief engineer, and he was vice president of the company. Jack Campbell worked there, and Frank Drake was a graduate student who had a part-time job at Ewan Knight. One thing I remember about the interview is Ewan was sitting on top of a large home-built workbench. It sort of had a platform in the middle, and he was sitting up there talking to people who were working around the bench. And Strum had showed me around, and he just introduced me to Ewan, and Ewan said something like, give him a buck, put him to work. That was about it. They did offer me a job. It was a job. Actually, they didn't offer me a job. They got Harvard to offer me a job through Tom Gold.
I see. He was director then of the
Radio Astronomy. Project. Yes, and the job was to make a hydrogen line receiver, a 100-channel receiver that did not work. That is, to make it work.
100 channels?
Huh? Yes. There was a receiver commissioned probably 1954 or so. Ewan Knight was to build Harvard a 100-channel receiver with a digital output. It was supposed to type it all out on an electric typewriter. And it was one of the first disasters in equipment in radio astronomy. It just never worked right.
What were the basic problems?
Well, it was unstable.
Was it DC?
I think a few different schemes were tried. I think it was to be a DC comparison radiometer, mm-hmm. in terms of there's a reference band,
right.
which is compared continuously with each channel. I think there was trouble with the detectors, getting square law detectors that weren't too temperature sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
I think it had a lot of crystal filters in it. By the time I got to it, it was a very sore area, sort of between Harvard and Ewan Knight. I guess Ewan Knight got paid for it, though I don't think it was ever used on the telescope.
I see. Did Ewan Knight do other things besides the radio astronomy by that time?
Yes, they were building equipment for the military, also receivers for the military.
Yeah.
I guess I started by trying to build a switch, an RF switch for 21 centimeters, and I think I did that. But then we built a very modified receiver, that is, from 100 channels, we went to one channel. And another student, Ron Weimer, who now works at Greenbank, he came to work for Harvard, but at UN Knight.
Mm-hmm.
And we put together a simple receiver. We built the filters, just LC filters, and we installed it at Agassiz Station. Menon and Drake helped with it.
Mm-hmm. This is all the summer of 57 now you're talking about.
Well, no.
Oh, no, you worked
on. It went on, yeah. I guess I worked part-time during 57, 58, mm-hmm. and it was around the spring of 58. That we installed this receiver. I think I got out of radio astronomy the next summer. I went to work for Radiation Incorporated down in Florida. I worked on communication receivers.
What was going to be the advantage of this single channel thing over what
it
they
worked.
Had? That it worked. That they had nothing
yes.
that worked to... They'd been taking observations for a year or two, hadn't they, by that time? But maybe not all that successful.
They had something that worked, but I don't remember what it was, whether this was higher resolution or mm-hmm. just where it fit into
in any
the
case,
scheme.
It did stay on and was used for...
I believe so, mm-hmm. yeah.
So when did you next come in contact with radio astronomy?
Well, I started looking for a thesis...
You stayed on at MIT as
yes,
a graduate student.
Yes, right. Yeah. Let's see, graduated 58. The first year I was a full-time student. I had a fellowship, and I did a lot of looking into communication theory. That and microwaves were sort of the two fields that I specialized in. And I did an undergraduate thesis at MIT.
Mm-hmm.
Which I looked into the feasibility of detecting the deuterium line.
I see.
It was under Professor Siebert at MIT, who was a communication theory person.
Now, the Russians had claimed it, I think.
Yes.
Going back to, was that the Jodrell Bank meeting in 55, I think they made a claim?
I don't remember the... I think at that time there had been two unsuccessful attempts, AGI.
Right, in the West, yeah.
Yes, and the Russian claiming detection. But for this undergraduate thesis, I just wrote down the what temperature to expect in terms of the deuterium to hydrogen ratio, mm-hmm. and just got an idea of the problem. I didn't want to look for it at that time. I didn't plan to continue.
Were there any suggestions in the thesis of what was needed electronically
no.
to better look for?
Well, no, it just pointed out that the ratio of what you wanted to detect to the system noise, since it was thought... Well, it could either be an absorption experiment, in which case that ratio was limited by the fractional absorption. You know, it was something like 1 to 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
or an emission experiment would require a tremendously low noise receiver. So it looked pretty hopeless. Well, then I started looking for a doctoral thesis a year or two after that. And by the way, the suggestion of looking for deuterium came from Ewan. Uh-huh. When I worked there. He thought that would be a good thesis. Then the doctoral thesis, I talked to several professors. Wiesner was one of them. Mm-hmm. Wiesner was interested in radio astronomy. And he thought the deuterium line would be a good thesis. I started looking into ways of doing it, sort of coming to the conclusion that stability and long integration time were the only hope. A multi-channel receiver, of course. And stability led me to think of digital processing. Autocorrelation techniques were a big thing at MIT in those days. That is, Y.W. Lee and Wiesner and some other people had written papers about correlation techniques. So my original intent was to build a digital correlator with many bits. That is, I didn't realize at first that very coarse quantization could be used. And
that it could be used without too much degradation.
Yes, I didn't think that was possible, but one of the first problems I started working on was how many bits did I need. Mm-hmm. And the simplest problem was to take the case of one bit, see what would be the loss for one bit, never thinking I would use one bit, but...
Yeah, right.
And I worked that out, sort of using statistics that I had, signal processing theory. And I was sort of very shocked that you could make an unbiased estimate. That is, you could correct the mean of your result, mm-hmm, to get to the true,
right,
correlation function. I wasn't even looking for that. I thought there was some error that no correction was possible. And I don't think I computed the loss in signal to noise at that time. I worked out this result, sort of this sine relationship between the two normalized autocorrelation functions. And the very first person I told it to was another graduate student named Irv Stiglitz. And Irv said, "Oh yeah, Van Fleck did that, 1943. Since then, I don't think I had ever told anybody.
Excuse me.
I never told anybody after that who knew of that Van Fleck paper.
Uh-huh.
But this first guy I met over in the drugstore across the street from MIT, and he had known about it.
He gave you that big clue.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't. It was